is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
A very good afternoon to you, Warwick Long with the Country Hour today. Today on the program, some planning changes around farmland close to Melbourne. No houses to be built on farms less than 40 hectares of farmland within 100 kilometres of the city. Is this going to affect you? How do you feel about greater protections for farmland? Is this something government should be looking at? You can send a text 0467 842 722. Or you might want to talk about fast fashion. We are going to France today on the program to hear from French campaigners trying to put charges on fast fashion items, which is seen as something that could benefit wool growers and other fibre producers in Australia greatly. How does that all work? We will take you through that mind map today on the program. Plus, you'll hear from VicGrid on the changing of the route for power lines in Gippsland. All of that and more coming up today on the program.
The Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
First, let's start with planning laws right now. Farms that operate within 100 kilometres of central Melbourne will be protected from urban growth under new rules announced by the Victorian government to protect agricultural land. This change means that farms building a house on a farm less than 40 hectares in size within those farming and rural activity zones will be banned within the 100 kilometres of Melbourne under the planning amendment. There are further amendments attached to what was announced by Planning Minister Sonia Kilkenny. We have a request in with the Minister, and when we know more, we'll bring you more. But I wanted to go to peri-urban areas of Melbourne, to farmers operating in that area, to see how they feel about this. Wayne Shields is an organic vegetable grower on the Mornington Peninsula, has one foot in and out of close to Melbourne farming, because farms on the Mornington Peninsula also has farms along the Murray, where there's a bit more space. Wayne Shields, welcome to the program.
How you going, Warwick?
You've been reading some of these details from the government. What do you make of this change to better protect farmland in and around Melbourne? Is it a good idea?
I think long-term, for the good of Melbourne, it's a good idea. Not everyone will be pleased with it. Everyone's probably made plans for their own future along the way, and sometimes this might throw a spanner in a few people's works, but generally speaking, I think in the long run, it'll keep farming closer to Melbourne, keep the look of Melbourne similar, and give the people around here an opportunity to actually get into farming and not worry about what might be coming at them.
Can you take me to your part of the world on the Mornington Peninsula? How hard is it for a farm business like yours when you're looking to expand or grow to find land to farm?
Well, it's pretty hard to find, you know, greenfield sites that aren't overcapitalised, so that's one of the biggest restrictions. You know, old mate down the road might have 20 or 30 acres that he doesn't use and he wants to rent it out, but because he's got a house on it that's worth X amount of dollars, he thinks he can rent it out or do something with it. Or if I want to buy it, I've really got to buy the house to make that land productive, and it just doesn't add up. Farming's a pretty tough game, and once you're starting to pay off houses as well as just the land, it just doesn't add up. So there's a lot of places that just you can't even look at nowadays.
And so it effectively puts a cap on how much you can grow in a certain area, unless, yeah, there's this mythical greenfield site that pops up for you.
Yeah, and they're very hard to find nowadays. So every little bit of land seems to have a house on it or a shed on it or something. They're getting overcapitalised.
And because it's got a house on it, that means, you know, lifestyle blocks or other operators suddenly look at that and they're willing to spend far more money in terms of operating that farm than you would as a vegetable producer. Is that right?
That's right, absolutely.
So these changes would stop those sorts of development, would stop further houses being built on farms smaller than 40 hectares. And so you think that's a good thing?
Yeah, long term, I think it's a good plan.
Will it cost you if you want to sell your farm when you get a bit older as a farmer?
Yeah, look, it doesn't worry me at the moment, but maybe later on in my life I might want to sell it and get more money than I am at the moment. But, yeah, look, I think it's a point of the stage of your life, how you look at these sort of things. But I think if you stand back and take the personality out of it, it's probably good policy to keep Melbourne the way it sort of is, with this nice green band around it. Because the way it's going, there'll be a house on every single block. Every 5 acres will have a house on it, or 10 acres, and it'll just be a schmozzle. There'll be a heap of horses, a heap of motorbikes, and nothing productive going on.
One of the things the government says they're looking at as part of this announcement, obviously a lot of it around the protection of green wedge and farming zones close to the city, but there is also a call to improve the flexibility, I believe, is the wording, for farmers to sell produce at the farm gate. That has been a difficulty in your part of the world, hasn't it? So would that be welcome?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I've always been a big supporter of being able to do that, and it got extremely difficult there for a while, and we had to change how we went about things. But
you bought a store in town, didn't you, so you could just keep selling produce?
That's right. Yeah, things had to change. There's great opportunities for people to be, productive on their own land, and everyone needs an outlet for that. So, the general public sort of love that sort of stuff. So there's not a lot of losers in that sort of thing.
Other changes also exploring more opportunities for water authorities' views on peri-urban areas to use things like recycled water supply. Would that benefit farmers like yourself?
Oh, 100%. I mean, there's a history of recycled water going out to areas, and, 20 years after the recycled water's plumbed into these farming districts, that it suddenly goes to housing. So that's been a bit of a heartache for some people who can't get the water. So it'd probably be good policy that the bureaucrats can sit down and work out where the water's going to go, all this recycled water that we've got, where it's going to go, and then that'll be locked in for farming. And that's just productive.
This is seemingly a rare government planning change that has support from farmers like yourself. That doesn't happen every day, Wayne Shields.
No, well, like I said, I'm supporting it at the moment, but probably two or three guys down the road will be cranky. But that's their point in their life, where things are. But this is long-term planning, and it looks really good to me. I think this is what a lot of us were sort of asking for.
Well, Wayne Shields, thank you very much for having a chat about it on the program with us today. Good to talk to you.
Cheers, mate.
Wayne Shields there, organic farmer, vegetable producer down on the Mornington Peninsula, also near Barham along the Murray as well, with his thoughts on state government changes to planning laws. That would mean no farm houses, no dwellings to be built on less than 40 hectares of land for a farm size in the green zone within 100 kilometres of Melbourne. What do you make of that? You can send us a text 0467 842 722. You can keep that number handy, because let's talk another planning issue right now to do with power lines. As you would have heard on Friday during the Country Hour, the potential route for the high voltage transmission power lines through Gippsland has been revealed by government agency VicGrid. The study area starts about 6 kilometres from the coast near Gifford, travels northwest past Stradbroke West to Wollung, across to Flint's Creek, and connects into the electricity grid near the Loy Yang Power Station in the Latrobe Valley. VicGrid has ruled the proposed transmission lines will connect offshore wind projects to the grid. That'll be overhead, despite the push from the community to have those wires installed underground. But VicGrid says no, definitely overhead power lines, not underground. Here's Chief Executive Alistair Parker saying the proposed route will have a lower impact on agriculture.
So we've taken into account a whole load of factors in this, trying to minimise impacts on landholders, communities, the environment, keeping down costs for consumers. We've tried to avoid major townships. This particular study area has a lower proportion of agricultural and private land than most of our other options. And it also allows us to explore alignment with the existing Basslink route. There may be technical reasons why we can't do that, but at least we can have a look at it.
How many landholders would be affected under this proposed route?
Yeah, so it's not a route yet. It's a study area, but across the study area, there are about 300 landholders. And before we've done this announcement, we've tried to get in touch with all of them over the course of the last week. But so we recognise You know, this can be confronting information, and we're just helping people work through that.
I think one of those key areas in terms of why this information may be confronting is that decision to go overhead. Can you talk me through how VicGrid came to the determination that this project will be overhead as opposed to undergrounding these transmission lines?
So, look, we had a lot of feedback from the community about preference for underground in the Gippsland area. We also had a lot of feedback around concerns on cost of living, the cost of energy. And when we look at this, there's really three reasons why we've gone overhead. One is cost. Our estimates are that at the upper end, an overhead solution is about $1.5 billion. And an underground solution, again, at the upper end is about $4.5 billion. So that's a big impost on bills. It's also a very tight market for buying underground cables at the minute, and we think that would delay the project. And it's also, in the longer term, much easier and much cheaper to connect onto overhead transmission lines. And so for those three reasons, on balance, we've gone overhead.
It is a really complicated area. I think speaking with farmers, though, and affected landholders, their concern is why would this project not be able to follow precedents of similar projects, such as the Star of the South, for example. So should that project be successful, they have committed privately to be spending what would be millions of dollars to put their infrastructure underground. So I guess they're asking, why can't that commitment be made for this particular project?
Yeah, and look, that's a great question. We get a lot. Every project is different. We've really looked at this for this particular project and really mindful primarily of that impact on consumers. We didn't feel able to make that choice, but, you know, respect the commercial decisions of other organisations.
So should this be successful? I understand we're just still in a study area, kind of scoping out stage at the moment. But should this be successful, how much power will this route be able to connect to the grid?
As we develop it, the technology we have preferred will be able to provide roughly 2 gigawatts to the grid, and that's in line with the government's target for offshore wind as we replace coal. Just to give your listeners a hand, 2 gigawatts is about the size of the Melbourne CBD, or maybe the size of Loy Yang Power Station. You know, so it's a really significant piece of power.
How does this project work with what was already being scoped out by AusNet for their GRES project, which was affecting some of the same landholders? You know, they were doing their own consultation process back in 2022 to look at a very similar situation, which would connect offshore wind and any other renewable energy projects to the grid. What does this mean? Is this the same project, or is this going to work alongside that?
Well, look, the announcement we have made today is the government's preferred solution for offshore wind, and the government have made it clear previously that if offshore wind developers want to take part in future auctions for government support, they need to connect into this infrastructure. We've spoken to AusNet, and I'm sure they're considering what it means for their project, and we'll work closely with them on that.
But for those affected landholders who may have already been anticipating some power lines running through a particular corridor, are we now talking about a potential future of multiple corridors?
In our report, we talk about the long term. The government has a target of 9 gigawatts of offshore wind, and we have laid out some information of how much transmission infrastructure would be required for that. But that's not been the purpose of today's announcement. That's work we'll have to do in the future.
And I appreciate this is, you know, maybe a bit preemptive, because as you say, this is something future down the path. But if these offshore wind projects are to be successful, you say yourself that's going to be a 9 gigawatt capacity, but today's announcement is only to store 2 gigawatts or to transmit 2 gigawatts. So we are going to see a future where there are going to have to be more transmission lines connected to deal with the capacity for these future offshore projects, are we not?
Yes, we are.
Do we have any idea then what that looks like?
The 9 gigawatt targets is potentially spread across Gippsland and the Southern Ocean area. But in the report, we talk about the need for potentially a second corridor back to the Latrobe Valley and potentially a tie line between the connection points. So we will need to carry out further planning to really understand and scope those projects.
It's VicGrid Chief Executive Alistair Parker speaking there to Danielle Pope. A lot of your text coming in. Stephen says the overhead process is a dog's breakfast. Everyone has said underground, says Stephen. More text coming in along that. And some on planning as well. I'll come back to your planning text. It's just a moment. We'll keep moving. We'll move away from planning and power lines. Let's talk about something else that has been on the menu a lot lately, and that is dingoes or wild dogs in rural environments. But this is specifically for dingo. Australian researchers say they've found a new natural deterrent for dingoes, and it comes from, well, what some would consider an unlikely source, and that's the species' own urine. Yep, it's wee. When it comes to dingoes, the smell of the wee of a male dingo in his prime actually sends others running out of the territory. That's according to University of New South Wales PhD candidate Ben Walker, who says the revelation could assist in the development of non-lethal management tools for dingoes in farming areas. Mr. Walker says unpacking the chemical compounds that scare the native species away could benefit farmers, miners, Indigenous communities and tourism operators.
We've taken some dingo urine and we have placed it out in the landscape. We went to the Strzelecki Desert on Quinnaby Station and we ran an experiment to understand how dingoes might respond to new individuals that they hadn't smelled before. And these were adult male scents or urine samples. And what we were looking for was to see if they did anything, if they responded in any behavioral way. And what we found was that when they smelled this scent, they actually went very quickly away.
Mr. Walker says they tested urine from young, prime and old dingoes in captivity, and it was the prime samples that scared other dingoes away.
Animals that donated prime scent, so those prime animals, when a wild one smelled this, they were like, whoa, I got to get out of here. And they left much quicker than the other individuals, which they would stick around and try and find out more information. Alongside that, we also found that there was a little bit of an effect where the dingoes that smelled those prime ages, they didn't come back as quickly. They delayed a little bit, maybe a day or two more before coming back to the same site.
Mr. Walker says when they worked out it was the urine from the prime dingoes scaring others away, they took it back to the lab for analysis. And of the thousands of unknown compounds, they narrowed it down to just 5, which may be key.
One of those is found in 2 species of skunk, which, would you believe, makes sense because it's really smelly and lasts a long time. One of them is found in metabolites in mice, which, again, is maybe a mammal thing, and that has conveyed social status before. And then another one is found in, like, really, really harsh environments, and the compound doesn't break down in those environments. So I think that these 5 compounds are pretty useful to look at, but the list of 107 is made it a lot easier for us to sort of potentially work out something further later on.
Mr. Walker says they also tested the urine's chemical compounds after a month to determine if there was still presence of these 5 compounds. And there was. He says by understanding the cause and effect, potential non-lethal management tools for dingoes could be developed.
Yeah, absolutely. There's this option to both look at one compound and see how it might be developed to deter individuals in the landscape, Or you might have to look at ratios between compounds. So you make a mixture of two or three or four compounds and then see, do these actually have the same effect as the scent from the animal itself? And that is something that is ongoing. The best way forward is to sort of look at the next step of, okay, now we've got this list of compounds, maybe we can pick out two or three and then test it. And doing experiments out in the landscape with landowners, with First Nations people, I think would be a really important step, because we can understand and sort of work with the ecology of the species rather than against them.
Dingoes and wild dogs cost primary producers almost $50 million a year. There's also concern of dingo predation on remote mine sites, Indigenous communities and outback tourism. Mr Walker says he hopes his research may one day be used to create tools for those who need them.
Farmers, miners, as tourism operators, those First Nations people, if they're in that space, they know that space. And if they have other ways to approach a new problem, like what this research is, I think it might offer a relief of some potential tension and might give them another way forward or another type of approach to what could be quite a difficult space.
The research has been published in the journal Chemical Senses and was a collaboration between the University of New South Wales, Taronga Conservation Society and the Dingo Discovery Sanctuary and Research Centre. Greg Misford is the National Wild Dog Management Coordinator at the Centre for Invasive Species. He says while the long-term application in pastoral settings of such compounds alone may be limited, the research is still very interesting.
I think the work that's been done is really interesting, and their ability to separate out those volatile components and identify certain chemicals that dogs obviously detect and respond to is really interesting work. But I guess it comes back to the practicality and how they can be implemented in the field to protect livestock.
Last week, the Victorian government put an end to the killing of dingoes in the northwest of the state, saying the animal is at risk of extinction. Mr. Misford says non-lethal tools to manage dingoes and wild dogs has been gaining attention of late and may be applicable in certain settings in conjunction with other measures.
Oh, look, I think we've been exploring non-lethal tools for some time, but once again, it just comes back to that practicality and whether they're useful in the landscape. So we've been using maremmas in paddocks with sheep and livestock for a number of years, and the presence of a 65, 75 kg dog in a paddock urinating around the place in his prime certainly hasn't stopped dingoes from moving in and amongst properties and attacking sheep and stuff like that. So I guess, yeah, whilst non-lethal deterrents are seen as a way forward in some cases for dingo management, I guess we haven't seen those practicalities on the ground except for the use of exclusion fencing. Putting up a physical barrier is probably about the only tool that we've seen that has effectively limited predation by dingoes on livestock. And so I think, yeah, used in conjunction with certain other tools, there may be a value in it. But as you know, the number one tool attractant for wild dog control and dog trappers is generally urine, dingo urine or dog urine. So I think there is a potential there for sure, but I think it's probably fairly limited. It's probably integrated with other tools to fill gaps.
And Tony agrees with that guest on the text line there saying, you probably attract all the girl dingoes with a wee, says Tony. Another text saying Country Hour's gone to the dogs. I like it. Greg Misford, there, National Wild Dog Management Coordinator at the Centre for Invasive Species. He was ending that report from Tara de Langraft, and you can read more on that story online, abc.net.au/rural. Just before we go to rural news, just on the planning, this text says, hi to all at the Country Hour. The no house on farmland less than 40 hectares is nearly as old as the Vic planning scheme, but not at all new. It's just never been held up by local council, state government or VCAT. The money will be made in subdivision wins nearly every time. This is the government announcing smoke and mirrors. They'll get around it by rezoning land when they benefit financially to get around all the so-called protection. Ask a consulting planner. Previously, this is from Fiona in Sale, previously a Water Corp catchment officer dealing with house development applications on farms across Gippsland. Only Melbourne Water had enough money to stop it from happening. It's really interesting insight. Thank you for taking the time to send that to us on the program. 0467 842 722 if you want to send a text. Let's get rural news right now with Emma Field today. Good afternoon, Emma.
Good afternoon, Warwick. An international study has found over half of the expansion of irrigation worldwide since the year 2000 has been unsustainable. A global irrigation mapping study published in the journal Nature Water from the University of Delaware also says Australia is in the top 10 nations in the world for irrigation expansion. Lead author Piyush Mehta says a lot of development has been done in an unsustainable way.
We found that irrigation expanded by about 11% in the past 15 years, and about 52% of this irrigation was unsustainable, and it took place in locations already experiencing some form of water stress. Australia was also, it was really interesting. It was because it was among the top 10 countries that had the most irrigation in the world. And we found that Australia saw an increase by 41%. That is about 1.5 million hectares of irrigated areas. 57% of this irrigation expansion that happened in already blue water stress regions in Australia.
Western Australia's main grain handler, the CBH Group, will spend up to $450 million on upgrades and improvements to its supply chain this year, in line with its $4 billion investment in the network over 10 years. Two of the big ticket items this year will be the Cranbrook and Conongoring rapid rail and outloading projects, with construction set to start in the next month and complete in September 2025. Mick Dore, the Chief Operations Officer at CBH, says it will give the system better connection to the rail network.
With Conongoring, what that will allow us to do is to put more grain back on rail. I mean, the last few years we've been moving a lot of tonnes out of there by road, and this allows us to, you know, revert that back to rail, which is, you know, good for everybody. The Cranbrook site, you know, they've only got a couple of thousand tonne of capacity above rail at the moment, and trains are bigger than that, so we have to recharge. So it could take, you know, 6 to 8 hours to load and to recharge cells to get a full train load. This will allow us to do it in 3 hours, and we've got the siding length there to allow us to, you know, not foul the main line as well at the same time. So that's critically important, so that allows other trains past as well, which is a supply chain improvement across the Albany, you know, rail network.
And a bill to amend the Pastoral Act in South Australia has passed Parliament. The changes will allow pastoralists to consider options like carbon farming and conservation projects. Environment Minister Susan Close says the final bill included some minor amendments to address some legal uncertainties.
We'd heard some concerns that carbon farming might not be able to be undertaken on pastoral land, and we wanted to make sure that that was legally not the case, that it would be absolutely perfectly acceptable to have carbon farming occurring on pastoral leases. The other challenge that had been raised with us was a question of whether legally we were able to have areas that were set aside for conservation purposes but still within the pastoral land. And we've now put that beyond doubt as well.
And we don't often have racing news on the Country Hour, but the first foal from champion race mare Winx is set to be auctioned at a public sale in just 2 weeks. Winx became a household name, gripping the nation as she notched up 25 Group 1 wins and a world record 33 race winning streak. And the new foal apparently has the looks and attitude of her mother. The filly has gained global interest and is expected to threaten the all-time thoroughbred yearling sale records. Amelia Berlusconi reports from Coolmore Stud in the Hunter Valley.
She's been described as having spark and sass and mirroring many characteristics of her mother. For now, she's been dubbed Little Winx, the first foal out of the mighty mare sired by a champion in his own right, Pierrot. At 18 months old, this filly will hit the sale ring in just 2 weeks' time, a sale many thought may never happen. Part owner Peter Tighe says it was just the right time.
Oh, it's not my decision alone. I mean, the owners, three groups that own it. We discussed and just came up and thought it was the right thing to take it to the market and give everybody the opportunity to be involved.
With global interest, the filly is expected to break records. By just how much remains to be seen. The filly yearling record stands at $2.6 million, The all-time yearling record was paid for a black caviar half-brother in 2013. That price tag was $5 million.
And the very best young auctioneers have been crowned at the Sydney Royal Easter Show. Justin Oakenfall of Inverell in northern New South Wales took out the 2024 ALPA National Young Auctioneer title. He will now go off to Calgary Stampede in Canada to compete in the World Championship, and he says it's a huge honour.
It was a big shock to start with and a very big thrill. It's an honour and a privilege to receive it and be crowned the champion, and it's just been awesome. No, I wasn't confident at all, to be honest. It was business as usual, and you know, tried our best to prepare for it and just lucky enough to get away with it today.
And we wish him all the best in Calgary. And that wraps up Rural News.
Oh, sounds like good work if you can get it. Thank you very much for that. Emma Field there with Rural News. A couple of texts on the program. This one on Wald, on dingo control using urine from dingo. Says, g'day, Wals. I have a better solution than some smelling dog wee. My solution has no smell, but it does have a loud bang. Yep, that has certainly been part of the debate, hasn't it? Thank you very much for your text all the same. And on fast fashion, which we have a feature coming up on the program. We're going to France, we're going to New Zealand, we'll speak in Australia about how a change in French law around fast fashion could help Australian wool producers. This text, though, just on fast fashion, it says, I buy undies at Target or Kmart. I used to get 10 years out of a pair 30 years ago. Now I'm lucky to get 2 years out of one. Fast fashion is bad. But poor quality is spreading. Thank you very much for that bit of information and that mental picture as well, anonymous texter. Let's go to Stephanie Miles, who's a senior forecaster on duty at the Bureau of Meteorology, to save us from our own text line. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Warwick. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. How's it looking around Victoria today?
Today, looking really nice. We're very much under a high-pressure ridge at the moment, which means we've got some real nice west-to-east winds. So some pretty strong winds over the coastal waters and a couple of strong wind warnings. But the rest of the state looks rather settled, with a couple of isolated showers along the coast and a little bit of cloud. But then the rest of the state, beautiful clear skies and a really nice settled day, Warwick.
And how do we go throughout the week from here?
Yeah, sure. So from tomorrow onwards, from Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, we've got very similar weather conditions. So very settled in some more southwesterly flow. We're still under that high pressure ridge, which means in the south we'll probably have a couple of cloudy mornings with a couple of isolated showers here and there. Places in the north remaining sunny with some really lovely days. Those temperatures remaining in the mid to high 20s. To that Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday period, but then it's from Friday onwards that we get a little bit of a change in the weather. So on Friday, our winds turn a little bit more northerly, so our temperatures start to come up 1 to 2 degrees, and we're going to have a really settled and sunny day on Friday. Now, that's ahead of the weekend. For the long weekend, in particular on Saturday, there's a bit of a trough that's deepening over the western parts of the state. So it is going to be a relatively mostly sunny day, those temperatures still remaining in the mid to high 20s, even low 30s for a couple of places. But with that trough in the west, we're expecting a couple of isolated showers and maybe even some thunderstorms just over the Mallee on Saturday. Then on Sunday, we've got very similar conditions as Saturday, with that trough kind of lingering over the western and central parts of the state for Sunday. So that means the shower activity will migrate a little bit further eastwards and be over our central districts and remaining over that Victorian and New South Wales border as well, but still those warm temperatures. So a couple of showers may be coming over the weekend, Warwick.
So just along those lines then, and this is a very selfish personalised weather report, we're broadcasting from Riola from the Charity Carnival Easter Monday, sort of halfway between St Arnett and Bendigo, that sort of part of the world, Newbridge, I suppose, Inglewood, that kind of area.
Yep.
Am I going to be rained on, Stephanie, on Monday, or are we looking okay?
I think Saturday you should be dry. Sunday you might get a couple of mills. And by Monday, it looks like we're mostly in southerly winds once again. So perhaps being north of the ranges on Mondays, you might only get a couple of mills again.
Oh, I'll make sure I have a raincoat handy, or at least a big hat, for the equipment. That's good to know. Any warnings we need to be aware of, Stephanie?
Other than the coastal warnings around those waters today, there's maybe a couple sticking around in those eastern coastal waters tomorrow, but no other warnings. However, there is quite a lot of smoke around the state as we get some planned birds underway. So if you're concerned with that, check on the Vic Emergency app, but no other warnings out at the moment or coming at Warwick.
Well, thanks very much for the update.
Thanks so much, Warwick. Enjoy your day.
Stephanie Miles there, senior forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, having a little giggle because Paul in Mildura is having a little joke about pistol and boo. Especially whilst talking dingo urine. Thank you very much, Paul. I'd forgotten about Pistol and Boo, the two dogs that were banned from the country. 0467 842 722 if you want to send us a text. We're talking fashion now on the Country Hour because world-first anti-fashion legislation introduced in France, which could pass by June, could have the power to shift the fashion industry away from synthetics and back towards natural fibres, much of which is produced by Australian farmers. A bill was unanimously passed by France's lower house to impose penalties on ultra-fast fashion products, which are often made from synthetic materials. So I had a chat with Pierre Condamine from Friends of the Earth France, who is campaigning for this change. He says this is not only a big deal for France, it's a big deal for the world.
There was a law that was voted last week, and it is sort of historic because the law was voted unanimously, and also it is quite ambitious in the way it tries to tackle fast fashion. So what it does is that it defines fast fashion through the frequency of renewal of collections or of new models, just like, you know, brands like Shein are actually putting more than 7,000 new models on their website every day. And so based on this, it is like adding penalty to the definition of fast fashion. So if you are sort of practicing fast fashion for a brand, you would get some financial penalties that you'll have to pay, and it's up to 10 euros in 2030. So that's something quite big that would disturb the model of fast fashion that is, you know, relying on high quantity of clothes sold at very little prices.
So this is effectively a tax or a charge up to 10 euros per item of fast fashion clothing that people are trying to sell in France.
Yeah, it's not really a tax. It's more of a charge, let's say, because it applies to the producer, to the brands, not to the consumers. But then, of course, we know that the brands is likely to move it to consumers, but it's really a penalty on a bad practice that you would have as a brand.
And who decides what is fast fashion and what is not?
So that is a bit of the blur around the law, is that the threshold that would make you, you know, fast fashion is not defined yet. The threshold has to be defined later in a decree that will be taken by the Environment Ministry. We hope that, yeah, this will lead to ambitious threshold and not only to, you know, only a few of the worst brand being considered in the threshold.
So the law will set the framework, if you will, but that detail is still to be decided.
Exactly. But we hope that if we want it to be efficient, it will be a large perimeter.
And where are your efforts to get this law passed currently standing? So it's passed the lower house of French Parliament. Do you still need to get it through the Senate? Is that right?
Yes, exactly. So it was adopted in the first reading in the National Assembly by the MPs, and now it has to be adopted by the Senate. And that's something we fear a bit because we know the Senate is much more conservative than the National Assembly. So we hope that we'll still manage to get an ambitious text after the Senate vote, and that the government will keep supporting the bill as it is.
What is French politics? What's the timeline like for getting something through the Senate and ultimately trying to make it law?
So this is something that is not clear yet, but this bill was tabled a month and a half ago. So it's extremely fast for something that ambitious. And we can hope that by summer, by June, it will be adopted. Because the government has shown support for the bill, and it has asked for a fast procedure around its adoption. So we can hope really that by June it's adopted, and then can be enforced at the beginning of 2025.
Can you give me the big picture? What do you hope this legislation achieves? What are you trying to change here?
You know, the problem with fast fashion is the quantity of clothes that are produced, because we know that 80% of the environmental impact is due to production phase. So We know that this model really relies on producing a large quantity of clothes and then selling it at very low prices. And so, you know, the social impact that we know during the production phase. So what we hope is that if producers have to pay a bit more, and even sometimes not only a bit more, but like 5 to 10 euros, you know, the system cannot work anymore and have to reduce the level of production that they have right now. Because we know they're doing very small margins on the large quantity of clothes that they produce. So that's how they work. But if we just sort of put a financial obstacle to the system, we hope that it will reduce production.
Looking at this from either a farming or an agriculture point of view, will this change, if you get the change you're looking for here, if you get sort of legislation around fast fashion through France and then ultimately in areas around the world, do you think that changes what we produce? Does how we produce wool or how we produce cotton or other products start to change?
Yeah, that's exactly something we are hoping for, because that now 70% of clothes are made of polyester, so synthetic fibers that are derived from, you know, fossil fuel. And so we know that we're producing that many clothes because we can rely on fossil fuel. So if we're penalizing this, we're hoping that, you know, it could level the playing field with natural fiber producers. And I will also add that the bill as it is now is penalizing, you know, fast fashion brands, but it is also rewarding, you know, small environmental friendly producers. It is also something that is now in the bill, is that it's taking money from the bad companies, let's say, and so giving it back to local good producers.
Is this hard work, Pierre? Trying to get change?
Sorry.
Is it hard work for you, yes, trying to get change?
It is hard, but I must say that with this bill, we got something really ambitious really fast, which does not happen often in the country. But I think it's because of the circumstances, because, of course, you know, fast fashion is an issue for social and environmental aspects. But also in France, the clothing industry is collapsing. We lost 300,000 jobs in the last 30 years. And so we have a lot of brands in France that are closing doors because of fast fashion, because of ultra fast fashion. So there is also an economic issue behind this. And that's why it got, you know, was done so fast in France, is because the textile industry is also asking for more regulation. And they're asking to level the playing field with, you know, those big brands producing in Asia at very low cost and so on.
That's Pierre Condamine from Friends of the Earth in France speaking to you. They're campaigning for that world first anti-fast fashion legislation. Basically puts a charge, he didn't want to call it a tax, on fast fashion items. And that has passed one level unanimously in French Parliament. It's now moves on to their Senate, which is more conservative, but that's the interesting thing, hearing that idea about how it's being pitched at conservative politicians as an economic thing, the loss of thousands of jobs, hundreds of thousands of jobs in French fashion houses over generations, and how to sort of arrest that decline. Well, you know who else is watching this closely? The Australian wool industry as well, because those key measures, including a ban on advertising for the cheapest textiles, targeting low-cost items, putting charges for their effects on the environmental footprint, something Australian wool growers think they could take advantage of. Australian Wool Innovation, which is the marketing, research and development arm of the wool industry, their CEO John Roberts says the devil will be in the detail of the bill, but if it passes, it could be a great market opportunity for the industry in France.
I think on the surface, it looks very encouraging from a wool grower perspective. You know, there's a proposed impost on ultra-fast fashion, which is going to, and obviously a ban on advertising of fast fashion. What constitutes those levels of fast fashion needs to be seen, but on the surface, I think it looks pretty positive for natural fibres like wool.
So one of the major reasons that this law has been put into place is there's a large environmental impact of fast fashion textiles. What are the benefits going to be for natural fibres, do you think, in that market now?
Oh, look, I think, you know, what's interesting now is, and we've been on this journey for over a decade as a wool industry, trying to actually put forward the eco-credentials of wool and actually counter some of the greenwashing that's been happening in the fashion space for a long period of time. And I think what's nice is that some of our efforts are starting to be realised. I mean, we did our campaign of Wear Wool, Not Fossil Fuel 2 years ago now, and I think some of the results of that are starting to permeate in big wool growing or wool consuming nations like France.
What will this bill mean for Australian exporters if it is passed in the Senate, do you think?
I think ultimately it'll be reflected in the wool auction rooms of Australia. I mean, we spend a lot of time competing against man-made fibres, and those man-made fibre brands have you know, marketing budgets that dwarf ours. I mean, they are giants. And I think if they aren't able to advertise and push and potentially greenwash in some of these situations in terms of their eco-credentials and wool's able to stand on its own two feet fairly, I think that's going to overwhelm the demand, and that should actually be reflected in the prices that exporters pay in the auction room.
If France passes a law like this, how significant is that to Australia's export market?
Oh, look, it's very significant. I mean, France, per head, have been a significant user of wool for generations. So, and they're a highly influential market. Their brands are some of the most influential in the world. So to have that, to have a market like France, a huge wool-consuming market, to do this is very significant. I'm not going to start popping corks just yet. I think the important thing is the devil's in the detail. And we do want to understand exactly what defines some of these and how these categories of ultra fast fashion versus fast fashion, and what the methodologies for measuring these eco credentials are. I think that's important, but it certainly augurs very well at this stage.
So, do you think Australia should consider similar legislation?
Oh, well, I think they are. My understanding is there was the Seamless Act has been proposed by the current government. So I think similar actions are being looked at in Australia.
And do you think these laws could influence consumer spending long term?
Absolutely. I mean, if the consumer has got to be, it's becoming increasingly discerning. And we know that the Gen Zs of this world are going to be label turners, much more so than the previous ones who had more of a faith in a brand. People are actually prostituting brands a lot more these days. So if people can start looking at fibres and ingredients that go into garments and understand the truth about eco-credentials, I think it will all go very well for the industry, for the wool industry in particular.
What about the cost of living, though? We know that a lot of people can't afford much at the moment. So if fast fashion isn't in the market anymore, do you think people will be able to afford natural fibres?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. You know, you look at what's happening when in some of the survey work that's been done. A lot of people are adopting that philosophy of buy once, buy well, rather than this high turnover, high churn of low garments, dispensing them, wastefulness, these sorts of things. So the philosophy of buy once, buy well. Yes, it might be a higher price point at the beginning, but ultimately the consumer saves money longer term. That is certainly a philosophy that's being adopted in a lot of those markets. So I'm not sure it's going to impact us too badly, actually. It might actually benefit us.
That is the CEO of Australian Wool Innovation, which is the peak marketing research and development body for the wool industry, John Roberts, speaking there to Jane McNaughton. He's saying buy once, buy well is a solution to fast fashion. Dan in Albury is not having any of it, though. He's like, fast fashion. So big fashion is wanting to tax people making inexpensive clothing that people who can't afford brand name clothing. What the? Big business is trying to monopolize, and that's not right. Coming in on the text line, you can let me know how you feel about it. 0467 842 722 if you want to send us a text on the country. I'm happy to take your views. Also happy to tell you about livestock markets. We've got a few of them to get through today. Let's get into it. And as we rock around markets, we might start with the sheep and lamb markets today, and we'll head to Bendigo to find out how they're selling. before the public holiday next week. Jenny Kelly can tell us more. Good afternoon, Jenny.
Good afternoon. Less lambs at 13,700 head in the lead up to the Easter break. The market was dearer by $10 to $20 over heavy and trade slaughter lambs, but in carcass price terms didn't quite hit the heights of Wagga last week. It was the light and secondary lambs in the 15 to 20 kilo weight bracket which really lifted at Bendigo today. Some of these MK type categories up by $25 and more. Export lambs over 30 kilos carcass weight, 185 to a top of 244, to be trending around 660, 670 cents. The 26 to 30 kilo lambs, 160 to 212, to be around 650 cent mark. Heavy trades, 145 to 174, and the medium trades, 22 to 24 kilos, 130 to 158. A lot of these lambs estimated between 610 to 660 cents. Pushing up into these carcass cost points were lighter and plainer lambs, decent types with frame from 90 to 130, smaller lambs mostly 50 to 90. Sheep prices varied either side of last week, with light mutton lacking some buying activity today. Jenny Kelly for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Jenny. Let's go to the cattle markets now and work our way through there. We'll go to Wagga Wagga first and Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. In today's sale report, the standard feature was the resurgence of restockers following favourable rains up north. With a yarding of 3,365, there was a notable presence of lighter weight cattle suitable for restocking purposes. Feedlots did dominate across most categories, propelling prices upwards. However, there was scarcity of cattle suitable for domestic processes weighing under 500 kilo. Restockers saw a notable increase of 15 cents, with prices ranging from $3 to $4.08. Feeder steers in the 280 to 330 kilo range witnessed a significant surge of 100 cents, commanding prices from 366 to 392. Medium weight feeder steers improved 13 cents. Heavy feeder steers saw a gain of 30 cents, averaging $1,712 a head. Heavy steers and bullocks destined for processors lifted 25 to 35 cents, fetching 280 to 324. Cow buyers faced intense competition for well-finished heavy types, resulting in a surge of 15 cents. Heavy cows traded 225. Trade heifers experienced a decline of 8 cents, 240 to 315. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Leanne. We'll go to Mortlake Cattle next in our run along the cattle run. Chris Agnew, take it away.
Thanks, Warwick. Numbers came back to 1929 head at Mortlake, a decrease of 550 on last week's offering. It was a good offering over most categories for the top end only, with some cattle still showing the effects of dry conditions. Not all the regular processors were present or active. Despite this, the market was very strong over most categories. Bullocks and manufacturing steers increased by 20 to 30 cents. Trade cattle and vealers gained 40 to 50 cents. In places, and all cows remained firm to slightly dearer. Grown bulls gained 15 cents. This week, the offering of vealers made between 300 and 364, trade steers and heifers making between 285 and 356. The grown cattle topped out at 350 cents. Manufacturing steers sold up to 259 cents. Heavy beef cows making between 210 and 258. The medium weights 180 to 210. Well-covered dairy cows generally making between 165 to 220 cents a kilo. At Mortlake, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Chris. Lucky last in the markets today, it's Pakenham Cattle. G'day, Brendan Fletcher.
G'day, Warwick. Numbers decreased to 1,080. That's 70 fewer, with the regular buyers present but not all operating fully in a mixed market. Quality was limited, with many lots lacking finish. Well-finished trade cattle lifted 5 to 10 cents. Plainer lots remained hard to sell. Ground steers lifted 15 to 20 cents. There were very few bullocks. Manufacturing steers gained 5 to 10. Cows sold 10 to 25 cents dearer, with processors loading cows for an estimated 301 to 490 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls lifted 20. Vealers sold from 220 to 390, yearling trade steers 300 to 400 cents, the heifer portion 250 to 360. Ground steers and a few bullocks 288 to 330. Heavy Frisian steers 180 to 256, crossbreds 226 to 312. Most light and medium weight cows 110 to 232, heavyweights 180 to 258, heavy bulls 228 to 246. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks very much for that, Brendan. That's about all the time we have for you on the Country Hour today. Remember, you can continue to get rural news and information by going to abc.net.au/rural. There you can read right now about goats that were meant to be for the meat market now supplying mohair to Italian fashion houses. There's also a story on that Tongala dairy factory that is set to reopen this year. We were chatting about that last week on the Country Hour. A lot of information on supermarkets. There's plenty of information on the stories that you would have seen on Landline on the weekend as well. You can get Brandy's Landline Market Report as well. It's all there. There's plenty there to check out. abc.net.au/rural. If you want to get in contact with us, you can always send us an email, countryhour@abc.net.au. Happy to get emails from you as well. Till then, till tomorrow, have a great afternoon.